Welcome back to ICN Season 3 Podcasts. This particular season, we are exploring the nature of community, of connection, coming from different points of view. We've talked about Holy Spirit and how that influences and subsists in our capacity to be alive with awakened consciousness, and how that influences our relationships with each other. Today, we're going to explore two really important dimensions in the realm of relationship, the realm of community, and what it means as practicing mystics, what it looks like, what it sounds like. We'll provide some examples. I'm really excited to jump into this subject. So, Luke, welcome. I always feel funny about the way that we do these podcasts, and I'll probably edit this out, so just feel free to talk as is. But Luke, we welcome this conversation, and why don't you help us jump in to how ICN is currently working with how we define mysticism and community, and the way that that influences our trust with and for one another.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's good to be back talking together again, David, you and I, and we're going through this this series on practicing mystical community. And last time we laid down some of the foundations of how we do that and why we're engaging in community. And so today we're going to continue forward with that exploration. And again, you know, we're leaning into community, as you were kind of saying, like this is a spiritual work of love in relationality. This is community is the invitation into that. I feel like, you know, in a lot of spiritual settings that I grew up in, community was more of a byproduct, or perhaps even a commodity, right? It was an audience. It was a group that wasn't why we were there, right? We were there to learn about Jesus, or we were there to worship or do these things. But community was just sort of something that happened along the way. But we're really wanting to lean into community in an intentional way because it's important to break through the illusion of our separateness,
yes,
of our self-sufficiency, and our spiritual isolation. I think those are things that we feel a lot, maybe unconsciously, right? There's this sense that our spiritual journey is individualized. It's something we do on our own. We have this perhaps sense of independence or self-sufficiency, right, in how we approach our spiritual practice. And I think because of that, because we're brought up into that, right? Our education system, our upbringing is personalized. It's individualized. We all go on our own track. You learn what you need to. You get the training. You do your career. It's all very individualized. And so in the church setting, what we learn, what we practice, yeah, we can be with others, but there's not always this deep sense of interconnectedness, this real connection in the communal experience of spirit, of consciousness, of awakening to the divine. Certainly there can be, of course, lots of ways. But when we talk about the relational field and where love fleshes out in the messiness of relationship, in engagements with one another, with other people who have their particularities, their quirks, their shadows, right? We're not always, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I think many of us aren't prepared or ready for deep community. We long for it, but so much in our culture has not set us up to have the capacity to connect deeply with others. It's actually something we need to practice. It is a spiritual practice. We may even need to grow our heart consciousness, right? We talk a lot about expanding our minds, learning more, getting more information, right? In a lot of ways, we're expanding our consciousness through what we know. Community invites us to expand our heart consciousness through how we are with one another. Kind of a funny story of this that I like to draw on is from The Grinch and how The Grinch stole Christmas. And, you know, The Grinch is kind of right, your stereotypical curmudgeon, and his heart is three sizes too small. But in that story, right, the heart of a Grinch grows. And I have this vivid image in my mind from the cartoon, watching it as a kid, right? The little picture frame comes up and zooms over it, and it even breaks the frame, right? It grows three sizes too big, or I don't, maybe some, if that's the line, but it relates for me. If I remember, growing up and praying, you know, God, take from me this heart of stone and give me a heart of flesh. Yes, yeah. I remember wanting a deeper heart consciousness that was filled with love, with capacity to connect deeply with others that I couldn't always do, because of wounding, because of personality, because of, XYZ, all these other factors that we all carry. We all have things in our lives that make it hard for us to connect deeply with others. And so, we need to, you know, take up the spiritual practice of growing our heart, and enhancing our heart consciousness. That's one of the things actually that people reflect a bit practicing whole body mystical awakening, sometimes, you know, moving into their heart, sometimes for the first time, or maybe they haven't done it consistently and actively. People will even sometimes say like, oh, there's like this tension or like a strain, or it feels like a pressing against the chest, and it's almost even painful. Say, okay, you know, that's all right. That's just your heart consciousness expanding, right? You're just pushing the boundaries. You're breaking off that frame and containment, and encapsulation or isolation that sometimes we have around our heart energetically. So this is a practice to cultivate our capacity for connection, which is a phrase from Parker Palmer. So I'll stop there and David, let you chime in.
Oh, wow. There's so much to work with. I'm glad that you brought it back to WBMA, because Whole Body Mystical Awakening is a classic example of how that practice is not just for us as individuals, but the whole body, not just my whole body, but the whole body, right? This is, I mean, you take a, Paul the Apostle's classic theology of becoming the body of Christ, which is one, right? Many parts, one body. And there's something to be said about the fact that, you know, you brought it up earlier. You used a relational term. You used the term relational. And what sprung up for me is, and I don't think this is wrong, I think this is part of the differentiation process. So I'm not bringing it up in a critical sense. But when, you know, there's a book that came out some years ago. It was very, very popular. Thank God it was, because it's done good in the world, about emotional intelligence. But when you take that phrase or that title, the pressure is on the individual, for the most part, to become the emotionally intelligent. And that's true. You know, someone else can be a terrible person, and in terms of how I experience them, but I have to be the one to practice emotional literacy, whether or not they do. That's true. And we need more of that in our world. But there's also the relational intelligence, right? Yeah. And it goes with emotional intelligence, but it does. It's not all about the individual becoming the whole. As much as that's important, I cannot become whole if those around me are also not becoming whole. And each of us participating with that phenomena.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very dynamic, because, you know, there is this sense of like, well, I can only take care of myself, right? I can only do what, yes, I can do, and I have to own my own stuff and work on it, and they'll be all in there, true. You know, yeah. I can't fix them. I can't, you know, and that's true. Yeah. But what you're saying is so crucial, because if we're not careful, that can just reinforce the individualism of the heart, of the emotional space, of the whole body, right? Even, right? There can be this, and we'll talk more about boundaries here in a little bit, but there is definitely something about the relational dynamic, about going beyond the I space, right? Outside of what we can control, into a relational situation. And that's love, right? We know that from, you know, romantic relationships, from siblings, from family, from any relationship of love that we've had. It's like, yeah, there can be times where we're going to say, well, this is what I need to do, and this is what, and they're in this place, that's all part of the field. But yeah, the relational engagement and imposition that relationship has on us is all part of community. And there's a capacity there. There's a of what we can hold that is making space for the other in their woundedness and in their beauty, and in making space within ourselves in our woundedness and in our beauty as well. So how do we cultivate a bigger capacity to hold more of that relational complexity, more of the imposition, more of the intermingling space or the intertidal zones between us, right? Because it's not a clear cut breaking off, right? We are interconnected, yes, on the emotional level as well. And so when we deny that, we're actually disassociating from part of our greater, more holistic humanity. So we really do have to work to increase the capacity for that. It's not natural. It's not inherent. And sometimes what that takes is being broken open. Yes. You know, going back to the Grinch story, you might remember his heart breaks open when he's hanging upside down, holding on to the sleigh, right? Trying to save all the toys and presents that he'd just stolen. But it's, you know, our life sometimes has to get turned upside down. We need, maybe sometimes we even need that imposition of someone coming in and, you know, digging the nail underneath the skin, or right, getting at us in ways that we wouldn't want or choose. And that can be one path toward opening up into community more deeply. You know, Parker Palmer, who I mentioned earlier, coined this phrase, cultivating capacity for connectedness. He describes it this way, where he says, breaking your heart, which we normally understand as a destructive process that leaves one heart in fragments, is reframed as the breaking open,
right,
of one's heart into larger, more generous forms, a process that goes on until the heart is spacious enough to hold both a vision of hope and the reality of resistance without tightening like a fist.
Powerful. And leave it to Parker Palmer to put it in such a powerful way. And I'm wondering if we can lean maybe a little bit into something you were pointing to just a moment ago. It's just so fun to talk about these things because it's a challenge to my brain that wants to splinter off into multiple directions to talk about all the great things being brought up. But I really feel like it's important as we're talking about emotional, relational, community health and openness, which I prefer sometimes over the term intelligence, which can make people sound like they're stupid, which is not what we're doing, of course. Mm-hmm. But you brought up this idea of boundaries. And often, when it comes to the I, we, all, the term control is where a lot of suffering arises, where we're trying to control the narrative or control the other or control where the group is going. And that can be where a lot of suffering arises, especially if it's not healthy control. Which I think scripture is interesting because at least the way it's interpreted in the English text, there's an idea of self-control. In other words, I'm not just going to say whatever pops into my mind or whatever emotions are coming up for me and, you know, do things that are shameful and hurting. But I'd like maybe for us to just maybe tease out a little bit of the tension, which is some of what we're talking about, between letting go and control. And healthy control, I'm going to qualify that as healthy control. In other words, we do have to define those boundaries. And doing that means that we have to have some kind of guidelines, right? But not control freak. And that's a very hard subject to parse out and really make nuanced. But would you be willing to kind of explore that for just a second?
Yeah, definitely. So the boundaries among and between us that we mentioned before, we're not separate from one another. We are interconnected. There is an interflow. There is the relational space which moves between us. And the ground of that is trust, which we'll talk more about in a little bit. But when we have, right, this process of things that come up, things that enter the field, things that come between us, right, we have a desire to be healthy, right? I like that framing a lot better as well than intelligence, right? There are healthy expressions of community and relationality, and there are unhealthy expressions. And in response to that, the response to that is different, how we engage with that. I think for now, what I'll say about that is that the practice of community brings that still into the relational space. Yes. It's not something that we individually can control, right? Hold, can be with. And that control, yeah, that's a tricky word. But there is a process of navigating and negotiating that relationally, of being in the space with one another in ways that invite us back into that shared space, right? Back into the heart space, back into the relational engagement. And where that breaks down with, I think, unhealthy boundaries is when we're othering, when we're setting apart the other as something separate, right? This energy of division that's so predominant in our culture, that's so present and is unconscious in a lot of ways, right? We want to do that. We want to set apart and distinguish and close ourselves off from that toxic element or that that thing that is unhealthy. And that might be true. That might be necessary. That might be the best thing. But I think we want to be very conscious of that with others. So there's the parties, and we'll talk more about conflict and things later on in the series as well. But so they're the parties that are on the other side, but community brings that into a relational space where it's not just a binary. It's not just a dualistic sense. There are other presences of support and holding that and creating a field that where there is always the other and there is no other. Mm. So how we engage with the other in community in the we, because in the we, there is I and you, and you and you and you. Again, it needs to be more than just two to be healthy, I think, yes, most of the time. And so those energies of division that set us apart, the boundaries, the desire to control, it's a complex relational dynamic. And that doing that in a healthy way, in an emotionally and relationally intelligent way, is not something that we personally, individually can grasp and hold and control all by ourselves. We can take that also into the context of the larger community that can support us, that can provide wisdom, that can really help us in that process. Whereas a lot of times that also can be, we think of that more as an individual thing, right? Oh, this person's toxic. I'm going to cut them off, right? I ghost them. I'm done. I'm gone. Yeah. And that's not healthy either. Nope. So.
Well, okay, so you're off on a wonderful trajectory that we weren't planning on going, but this is going to be fun. Because when someone is toxic, let's say, and I think that word gets used a lot, that I'm not making a comment on how you've used it, but so much as it gets tossed around constantly.
I used it a little tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, no, yeah. And you, the way you used it was great. But it did stimulate the thought that, you know, in our culture, we say pretty much everything is toxic, right? And there is some truth to that, of course. But sometimes a little bit of toxins in the system helps us to build up a stronger resistance to the toxin, right? We get colds. We get the flu sometimes. If we inoculate ourselves or everything, things just, you know, mutate and come after us more aggressively sometimes. And what I'm trying to get here is sometimes, you know, the mysterious ways of the universe is that there's no such thing as an idealistic, utopian, spiritual community. There's always going to be struggles. And some of that is for evolutionary purposes. So like, for instance, and I know this is a massive rabbit trail, but
no, it's not.
I think what we're seeing at a cultural level, and I don't want to get distracted on national politics and everything, but all of those things are distractions or God surrogates until humanity decides to keep growing and developing beyond national identities and political identities. But, we're seeing a massive amount of polarization going on right now that does come across as toxic at its extremes. But I think we're also seeing maybe on the other side of it, which is going to take struggle, there's going to be a greater unity. That's what it means when I hear hope and envisioned hope from the Parker Palmer quote is that it's not a time where we will not have friction or struggles or being sickened by behaviors or emotionals or someone's traumatic reactions to situations.
Yeah.
But if I become healthier, maybe there's a potential for the other who is othering me can become helpful. Does that make sense? And let me give you a quick, I'm sorry to do this, but let me give you a quick example. Because I had always learned from childhood training, from home of origin issues and personality and all that stuff, is to implode. I would always implode. If there was, it was my fault, I have to absorb it. I have to take responsibility for it. You know, it was always this sucking in of the trauma that was going on around me and becoming self-destructive. That's gotten better over the years, of course, but that's a natural tendency to do that. So, for instance, and I'm not saying this as a license to use anger against people, but to have a sense of control that I have boundaries. And it's okay for me to say, you've crossed the line. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be subjected to that kind of behavior. That's an example, not the example of what we're talking about here, that to envision hope, sometimes friction is required. And if we're not, we're usually trying to avoid conflict or create it and then walk away, or you get the point.
Yeah. Seal off from it or run away or right. And all these things are individual compulsions often, right? And they're trauma informed and they're, you know, based on our upbringing. And so being conscious of those things helps, but we need one another too, right? That's where it's like,
blind spots,
we lack these broader contexts of community where other people can come in and either affirm that or say, actually, you know, maybe reconsider, right? Yes. Maybe this is coming out of control. So that's a way that we step out of that dualism. Right. And, you know, you're talking about another thing that's really helpful. We've talked about how intelligence can be a little problematic. Control is a problematic word. Health can be a problematic word too, right? You're kind of mentioning this idea of sterilizing, right? Or bubbling off, right? Or getting rid of all the bacteria. And, you know, that was an approach to health for a long time. And there are some, you know, positive aspects to that, of course, but we need the healthy gut biome, right? We need the complexity of the bacteria, and you can't seal yourself off from all of the unhealthy things, right? Actually, it's more healthy to be in that space of a little messiness, right? My kid drops their spoon on the floor, and you know, I don't want to trigger any germaphobes or whatever, but you know, right? It's that broader idea, right? This sense that we have to have a willingness to be exposed to something beyond what we define as our own individual sense of what is healthy, right? That's the dynamic that creates aliveness, that creates creativity, right? because the challenges, the ideas, and even the emotional things that are coming to us are going to stimulate more than what we can in and of ourselves in that isolated off bubble, in that sense of the health. That there is, Bio Kumalafi says, there's no community unless you are willing to be wounded. And so, you know, we have to be open to that. We have to recognize not only is that something that is going to happen and we brace for it, but actually, like the Parker Palmer quote, we embrace that because we know that that is what will make us more healthy or more whole or whatever language we want to use, right? That is the path through into greater connection. I think as well, the phrase to take heart. Okay, let's take heart together. When we have these experiences that break us open, can we turn toward them? Can we stay with it? Again, with boundaries, with a healthy sense of control, in the larger sense, to endure the dissonance, to endure the toxins in small degrees, or you know, whatever it might be that is actually enriching the field. As Richard Rohr says so often, right? The great love and great suffering are most often the path to transformation. And it's not one or the other, right? You can't just have all the love and the bliss and the goodness and the enfolded in that. The suffering is part of that too, and is actually welcomed and invited, because that's what grows our capacity for connection. But you got to have both, not just the suffering either. Sometimes we can get into the that side of it too much. So again, holding that in the larger relational field with the wisdom of the collective, with elders, with kin, with deep companions, that is something that I think a lot of people long for and are lacking. And so yes, that's what another area where community is so important, to find that, to cultivate that, and to create those support systems for one another.
Yeah, no. And I think this pushes us into a couple of, or maybe one really important aspect to this conversation, which is this holistic trust. But before we do that, a thought occurred to me as you were processing those reflections with us. And this is completely tangential, but just hang on, everybody, listen. I think a good way to maybe give an example of what healthy control looks like is the difference between a good movie and a bad movie. The difference between a good movie and a bad movie is when the people who are in charge, often in our individualistic culture, we make it one person, the director. And that person does have a lot of responsibilities, but it's a collaborative team effect. Okay. Or it's like, I've been in multiple bands, and the ones that were fun to play with were the ones that had good leadership or good direction that just said, we're going in this direction. We're not going to do that. We're not going to do this. We're going to do this. You can see the same thing like with healthy or becoming healthy communities is when there's a good sense of group control. We're about this. We're not about this. We're not going to be running off into multiple directions, right? And just be good at, like, okay at everything and not good at anything. And I realize, yeah, I'm being a little playful here, but I think one of the things that stands out to me on what you've been talking about is this idea of the spiral of trust. And in this sense, I'm kind of using a spiral dynamic language a little bit, because I think one of the reasons why we are allergic to becoming greater people, and I mean that in a healthy sense, like a larger than life person, not just filled with neuroses, but love displacing the fears that plague so many of our psyches, including my own, is that we know the more we open up, the more that we are willing to risk trust, the more we could get hurt. And it's understandable. And I've had to fight with this allergy, you know, as I've come into middle age. You know, it's like when you get wounded this many times, it can be really hard. And now you've got a body of evidence, either by family or family and friends or family and people who used to be friends. And just, you know that if you're going to continue growing on that spiral, you will be subject to greater risks. And those risk means risk, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What, like, it's, I don't know what else to say other than when we expand our capacity to trust each other and take that risk, if we can really truly sit with that relationality and that trust that's expanding, I think it gives us the strength to be able to face those risks at times. Who knows? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts here?
That's a great place to start, because it's really important that we don't bypass the significance of the wounding, the pain of loss, of disappointment, of failure, quote unquote. And choosing to trust is always a choice. And maybe that gets harder the more that we're wounded. On the other hand, the alternative is to become cynical, become skeptical. Yes. And maybe some people would say that's just being realistic. And on one level, they might be right. I was really impacted by a lot of the work of Brené Brown and the research she did around assuming positive intent, that people who do that are actually more happy than those who don't. When we come into a situation with a person, with others, and we assume the good, we believe that that they're being honest, that we can take them for who they are. Whether that is the case or not, whether that turns out to be the truth or not, we're more happy that way. We live more with a greater sense of joy. And that's because we're wired for connection, because we are meant to be relationally connected with others and to love. And so, again, we can't bypass the need for boundaries, for abuse, for, you know, this is really, really crucial to engage with. It also is not a license for people to do whatever they want. And this is crucial as well, especially in religious settings where there can be a lot of abuse and naivety when too much trust is given, when too much allowance is just freely afforded to people, to situations that really shouldn't be. So that's so crucial, because holistic trust is a trust in the ultimate wholeness that is underneath all things. But trust is always a choice. It's not unconditional. So we start from the place of trust, but that doesn't mean that we always trust, right? If someone shows us who we are, believe them, right? If we have been wounded, if there is repeated behavior of things that are unhealthy, of abuse, of neglect, of whatever it might be, that trust needs to shift. Maybe we can hold it in the field of the all, in the universal, that we do still have a hope, maybe then, a hope for healing, for restitution, for restoration, and love can continue to hope all things and not be disappointed. But I do think trust is conditional, even as we start from a place of assuming good, of believing that we can trust people. I think it has to start there, but that's not the end all be all.
Wow. My heart was kind of just taken in by what you were sharing. So it sounds to me like a really important element to what you're talking about in the capacity to trust one another and to this whole notion of conditional trust is really deep, but it sounds like one of the things that you're pointing to is the importance of practicing vulnerability, which I know Brené Brown has done a tremendous amount of amazing work in this. I'll just say, before I learned about that work, when we had first transitioned into the area of leadership 11 years ago, those first two words were trust and vulnerability. I said that will help us navigate and negotiate this transition that we're in as my wife and I take this leadership role. She, of course, filled it out beautifully in terms of the work that she's done. But how would you maybe flavor this uniquely through the ICN lens? I'm mixing metaphors there, but you get what I'm saying. How would we flavor that delicious plate of food through the ICN seasoning salt?
Well, yeah, the vulnerability aspect and the risk of that is always, I think that when we're in our minds, when we're in our headspace, again, we can convince ourselves, or maybe I'll just speak for myself. I know I can convince myself that I can understand this situation, that I can navigate it, that I can see through all the possibilities of where wounding might come, of where this might happen, right? That's my particular compulsion. And to enter into risk, enter into relationship is always going to encompass mystery, unknowing, fear, possibility of wounding. That vulnerability requires an unknowing. It requires the capacity, the potentiality to be hurt, to be wounded. And how we choose that, I think the deeper we go into our heart and into our womb and body, our feet, our rootedness, the more we recognize the illusion of that sense of the separate self being wounded, being destroyed, being beaten and broken down, yeah. Right? Because if we have an experiential connection to the depth of our common source, of our inherent unity in our ground of being, that ultimate wholeness is the source, the ground of a mystical trust that can arise, that can call us forward into a deeper participation in that which already is true, right? Vulnerability is in some sense just opening up to the realities of that we are relational beings, that love can hurt us, and we can't avoid that. We can't run from that. We can't close off to it. Maybe in some ways, in small degrees, we do need to do that to protect ourselves, right, from the wounding. But when we're talking about, again, seeking to engage in healthy community, moving into a whole body sense and awareness of that depth of interconnection, of that mutuality, will take us to that ground of trust. And then what fleshes out from there moves into complexity and specificity and different situations that need to be navigated as they do. But again, it's that, it's coming from that ultimate wholeness and recognizing that that is a place of mutuality. That's not a place of individuality. And so again, that's one of our foundational principles of practicing community, a mystical community, is that mutuality, that it is not just about me. It's not just about you. It is about us together. And again, not just two, three, four, five, six, right? Multiplies out. And that's where the complexity continues to come in. But there has to be a welcoming of the mutuality that will lead us more into the fullness of who we actually really are when we enter that in a more fully embodied way.
So at the risk of one slight moment of abstraction, one of the things that I love about some of the language we use with ICN is that it gives me constant things to work with. And I really enjoy that, not just mentally, but in practice. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you to maybe offer an example of how that's looked from maybe some recent life experience. But what was sticking out that I just had to bear witness to is I'm listening to you process and I keep thinking, I, we all, and I don't know if it's the male mind or if it's just the monkey mind or what that wants to say, well, how does that work? What does that look like? And what I kept coming back to is there is no geometric shape to this. Don't even bother. It's just, yeah. It's a flow. And it's like, what's more important? I, we, or all? You say, no, this isn't a pyramid. Well, what is it? Circles? Is it a Venn diagram? No, don't. It's not that it doesn't have distinctiveness, but when we honor those distinctions in order to unify as a practice, again, not as a concept, then we're able to flow with what is happening with a stronger sense of self. So for instance, let me give like somewhat concrete example. When we're in tension with one another, there is that tendency to dissociate or to cut off and so on and so forth. But if the I, the we, and the all is really the goal of a life practice, that's less of a temptation to go back to old narratives to say, well, these survival mechanisms got me here, so they're going to get me there. They're, you know, it's, no, like every opportunity is a new opportunity.
I'm really glad you framed it in that way because it is a flow and a constantly shifting complexity of the shape of interrelationality, right? I think of like fractals and sacred geometry, and you know, those are static, but sometimes you see the GIFs or the videos of those moving, right? And it really is more like that. And we maybe want the certainty of a particular shape to navigate and move through and know the parameters, and we struggle with the ambiguity and the uncertainty. And I've experienced that, yeah, definitely in community. A number of instances arise, and what again, without getting into the specifics of it, I'll just say, I think a lot of times what breaks down that flow is when in the communal space, we get too caught up in our agenda, in our preconceived sense of the way things should be, or what I want them to be, or what is the right thing to be, what they need to look like. We're almost trying to codify a certain shape to fix it as, and that is a resisting of the flow of that. And I understand why people do that, because ambiguity is hard, because uncertainty is constantly challenging. We have an instinctual survival mechanism to want to not have to use too much of our brain power to constantly be engaging with that which is unfamiliar. We want the regularity of things, so then we can filter them out and not have to devote so much focus and attention on them. So, so the ambiguity is hard, and I think I've experienced that, where in response to that, then people say, "This is what it needs to be," or "This is what it needs to look like," and often bringing past experience, bringing skill, bringing expertise. You know, all sorts of things that we value in the culture and in various settings, and that serve us well. Of course, we bring our gifts, but we're locking a little too much into the I then.
Right.
And so I've experienced that from others. I've experienced that in myself. It's something that I try to be mindful of and conscious of and recognize, because it is really easy to be fixated in the singular perspective, especially when it's our own, and we don't realize how we are hurting others, how we're really damaging the we. Even if we're deeply connected to the all and have this grand sense of a vision or possibility or spiritual spiritual values, or you know, it can be baptized and cloaked in righteousness. Mm-hmm. So often that's actually probably more often the worst case of it. And so I'm probably still being too abstract, because I don't want to get into too many specifics, because it's happened a number of times in various forms of community. It's so regular, unfortunately. So it is coming to an awareness and recognition of that, holding loosely what our perspective is, what our desires are, and that takes us back to mutuality, right? Can we dwell in a community with a sense of recognition and honoring and inspiration from the whole, the all, and from the we, knowing that I have needs, the community has needs, the field is complex. That's one of the reasons why I often resist boiling something down to a single goal.
Yes.
Or to this is the purpose of this. Well, you see it that way, and that's true, but there's also these five other purposes, and in 3 months there might be two other purposes with that, right? If we want to take it down to that language.
Yeah.
So there is this way of holding it. And I also want to honor and acknowledge my own compulsion. You talked about self-implosion. My tendency is to leave my own self and my desires and my needs and try to take care of all the things out there.
Yes.
So that's the way that I wound myself. That's the way that I actually withhold the fullness of who I am from the community, because I'm trying to make sure that everyone else is okay and getting what they want and what they need, which has been a new revelation for me, because I was never a people pleaser or
right.
I saw myself in that way. It's like, ooh, wow. Okay. Ouch.
No,
I need to actually be more in the eye for myself.
Yes. But, no, yeah. Let me just jump in on that. Cause if we're not clear, I did not see myself as a people pleaser. I still don't really see myself, cause it's not like I go around and just, you know, flowers and bonnets and none of that is going on. But there is the tendency to negate the experience of the self in order to make sure that the environment around me is not going to be any more dangerous, however that perception might be. So one of the things that I think might help this conversation, and I'll be vulnerable for a second. I being married for 27 years, has been a tremendous act of not just the mutuality of love, but the mutuality of learning to trust more deeply, learning to be more open, you know, learning to not share the marriage bed, but share each other with others, to share, you know, life energy, love, share community, share, you know, be vulnerable. But like the template for that in our context. So I'm not prescribing anything as a whole to everybody else, but just to keep maybe some of this from being just simply beautiful, beautiful abstractions, is to just say the way that this has kind of enfleshed itself is the way that we've tried to practice community with each other. So there's I am I am not Brita. I am not other than Brita. So there has to be healthy distinction in marriage, because I have not had her life experiences, yet she's shared her life experiences with me, right? So when, so like even down to a more concrete thing is when we have a difference of vision or value, or a difference in something as small as, you know, what do you want to watch next? If there comes any point of tension, is to literally relax the body, take a moment, take a breath before something else gets said, and really try to snap out of my fixed position and hear her. We've done this as a family as well, so not just in terms of relationship with a married couple, but to try to do this as a family, to show tension is normal. We have it. It's going to happen. But at least for us five, the commitment is always to a greater care for each other and a greater whole, and that, you know, we learn how to work through conflict with one another. So I'm not going to give specific situations on that, because that's too personal for a podcast. Yeah, but
sure,
you know, that's the way that we've tried to practice: is breathe, attune, you know, learn to be vulnerable with one another, so that when you're working things out, you're not continually violating each other. Does this make sense? So like there's a sense, and it's made me have a security to bring that trust out into environments that perhaps in the past I would have been more closed off, or at least more self-preserving, or those kinds of things. So it's like, I just went to a huge 700, 800 people group where I led some things. And it's because of all these years of practice that I could go into that as, you know, someone who's wired as an extreme introvert, to go in and just be a whole bodied presence, to be connected to my legs, to connect with the person sitting next to me, to be truly interested in them before I get up and do my shtick, you know, not to trivialize that, but just like, can I be with this person or these people in front of me? Can I be with myself? Can I be with the whole? And it is a dance.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, is this how does this sit with you?
Yeah. I mean, and that's a great example, because it comes from the place of deep mutuality and fundamental trust in a marriage, where you can wound each other, you can have disagreements, you can, you know, struggle through those things, but there is the bedrock of trust among you that knows that there will be repair, that you care about each other. And yeah, you learn processes and ways to do that more healthily. And there's a lot of resources out there on marriage and, you know, romantic relationship ways to help with that. I think bringing that to spiritual community is a really great parallel and connection to engage with that mutuality. Because again, it's going beyond that individual seeking of getting your own needs met or seeing your own agenda accomplished. And a lot of times we can go into spiritual community with that self-orientation, and it's really subtle.
Yeah.
It's really subtle. We might not even notice it. And we think that we're bringing our gift or offering that which we have. And that might be true as well, but there is a deep mutuality there that, where we're considering more than just my own needs, my own preferences, what I want to do next. Right. And we carry that into community. And if we can have that, I'll call it the courage of faith, yes. Faith being trust, right? Right. It's an act of courage to bring that forth in a setting that isn't as relationally deepened and connected as a marriage, right? You've spent a lot of time with, right? You've built these things over time, and that's generally the way that we build trust. And in a spiritual community, we need to do that as well, right? There is a trust building process that develops over time and reflects the way that we treat each other. And we're constantly inputting that data and reflecting that and engaging with that. But then there's also the fundamental courage of faith and bringing that into community, because that is the expression of faith that we enter into with the divine among us. We're not just faith in the belief of a God that is distant and might exist and we'll see in the future. The courage of faith leads us into the wholeness of the divine in myself through my uniqueness, and also beyond my particularities of being an introvert, of being fearful of this, or the way that I'm going to handle this situation because of my own wounding or baggage, but into the faith then from that of a greater wholeness that is possible in our midst, and not in an idealized sense, right? Not in a sense that everything's going to be perfect and that we're not going to get wounded, but the trust that that wounding will break us open if we can continue to turn toward it to a more full and healthy wholeness and evolution and greater development. That turning toward is the crucial part, right? After we break open, can we stay with it? Can we turn toward it? And we sometimes can't. Sometimes we have to leave. Sometimes it's too much.
Sure.
But that's the portal through which transformation happens. And I think that's also the place where we can recognize in community when others keep turning toward, right? There is that sense of care for the other, of recognizing your needs, of seeing the ways that I've hurt or wounded others and owning those and apologizing and repair. And those are the things that help make trust endure. And that will need to be foundational in any way that we practice community, whether in a marriage, in a spiritual setting, in a church. And giving that a little more attention, a little more focus, a little more conscious engagement to grow in that emotional intelligence, right? To grow in that emotional and relational health, yeah, and how we are with one another, because we can't do all the great spiritual things unless that's there too.
Hallelujah.